From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Reagan Edelman. It's no secret that drought and water shortages are a major concern for many cities, but particularly Arizona cities. And there are many potential solutions and steps to try and fight this. One of these is advanced water purification, aka AWP, which is also known as water reuse or water recycling. But it can be a challenge to get real conversations started on AWP and to get stakeholders engaged in conversations about AWP. But Christy Spackman is trying to change that, and she's doing it through an interesting medium, popsicles. Christy Spackman is an associate professor of art and science with a joint appointment between the School for the Future Innovation in Society and the School of Arts, Media, and Engineering at Arizona State University. She's also a researcher. Her academic work focuses on how the sensory experiences of making, consuming, and disposing of food influence and are influenced by what she calls the technologies of taste, a term that she uses to describe the oft-overlooked technologies and practices used to manage the sensory aspects of foods during production. Now, she's implementing her additional training in molecular biology, food chemistry, and the culinary arts to bridge disciplinary divides and to prompt meaningful discussions regarding food science, technology, government regulations, public understanding, taste, and water. Christy Spackman, welcome.
Thank you so much, Reagan. I'm thrilled to be here.
Christy, you got your bachelor's in molecular biology and chemistry from Brigham Young University before you moved on to get a culinary certificate from Kendall College, a master's in food chemistry from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and ultimately a PhD in food studies from NYU. When you were studying molecular biology and chemistry, did you have any idea that your career was going to take that route?
The closest inkling I had was I picked up an American Chemistry Society newspaper at one point during my undergrad. And they had this great article by Harold McGee about how copper might work in stabilizing egg whites. And that was my first inclination that there was a whole world of chemistry out there that I hadn't started thinking about yet. But it took me another 5 or 6 years to really figure that out.
What was the first step that brought you from getting your bachelor's in bio and in chemistry to switching to a culinary route?
Oh, gee, I've loved to bake for pretty much all of my life. I've baked horrible things and I've baked delicious things. And at some point when I was in high school, someone challenged me to make a list of goals in life. And one of the goals I wrote down was go to culinary school. And so I was working as a lab tech at the University of Chicago, and Kendall College had just opened a new campus. They'd moved their campus to downtown Chicago and were advertising, and it happened to coincide with a raise. So I took my raise and went to school at night.
And you now study taste and smell. What does that even mean? How does that even work? I feel like it's objective and it obviously doesn't leave a paper trail. So where did you even begin to study something like that?
So it turns out that there's this whole group of food and sensory scientists who spend all of their time trying to figure out how to take a subjective experience like taste or smell and turn it into objective numbers that you can then quantify and research and figure out, hey, what makes people tick when it comes to these things? And when I was doing my master's degree, I took some sensory science courses and started in on the work of doing that and just got really excited about the fact that there were these really careful ways of trying to take such a lovely, crazy, undisciplined experience, you might say, of sensing the world and try and turn it into something more disciplined. And I'm just really attracted by the inherent contradictions in that process.
Did you have any moments when you were first studying taste and smell that it really clicked? Like, this is possible and there's a vast world of science behind this.
For me, there are two kind of watershed moments. The first was when I was taking this food processing class and we were figuring out how to identify using our mouths and noses if milk had been improperly processed. So we mistreated it in the lab. We exposed it to extra heat or extra light, and then we would smell the food afterwards. And it was such a Proustian moment of having this, you know, smelling this milk that had been either frozen or exposed to light. I don't remember which, because they kind of produce the same smells. And sniffing it and being taken back to the grade school moment when I would pick up my carton of milk at the elementary school and open it up and it would smell kind of grassy or painty. And our professor said to us, this thing you're smelling, that's an aesthetic defect. It's caused by processing. And one of the things that you would do if you got a job in this industry is you or someone on the line would be tasked with sniffing stuff to just make certain it was okay before, you know, it heads off to the consumer, because we don't want the consumer to have that negative association with our product.
Christy, do you have to have a really strong stomach for work like this? I feel like as somebody with a sensitive stomach, being in charge of smell testing could go really poorly.
So, since I'm a researcher, not at a food company, I haven't had to have that full visceral experience. But, you know, when they talk to perfumers, one of the things perfumers do is they're very protective of their palates and their noses. They're pretty unlikely to smoke. They're pretty unlikely to try to expose themselves to really extreme sensory experiences because they're trying to protect their capacity. Now, my superpower is I get migraines. I love thinking of it as a superpower rather than a defect, in the sense that when I get a migraine, my sensitivity to smell just spikes. And so my capacity to walk through the world being overwhelmed by smells is pretty spectacular. So yeah, stomach turning certainly is one experience you could use to describe it. But on the other hand, there's all this really cool information out there available to us about the environment that we can detect when we sniff things, when we taste things. And so, you know, trying to think about it as a positive thing rather than, ooh, I like or dislike, but rather what is going on, really opens a lot of doors.
I do feel like smell is probably the most underutilized sense. Oftentimes, I think it's one that sometimes we take for granted.
I want to ping off something you just said, Reagan, which is the idea of our sense of smell being underutilized or underappreciated. I think what's really going on is we just haven't been asked to pay attention to it in the same way. And there's a long history to that. There's the idea that sight and sound are kind of the higher order senses and thus have been really valued in our education system, and smell and taste and touch have been less valued. And so we have that sort of historical background that really grows out of the Enlightenment in Western Europe and has shaped a lot of how we're educated. But you think about it, if you were to just stop, close your eyes, and sniff, you might realize that there are smells around you that you just haven't been paying attention to. And so it's really a practice of attuning ourselves to say, I want to pay attention to this, so I'm going to pause and think. And then, you know, you might get tired of it, so you let yourself slip back into not paying attention.
Christy, let's talk about water. About 2/3 of the human body weight is water. We've all been taught that since we were little kids. The importance of staying hydrated is something that was instilled in us. I believe the National Institute of Health right now generally recommends women drink 9 cups of water a day, men 13. And this, of course, varies depending on activity level, age, weight, all of those factors. But regardless, we're spending a portion of each day ingesting water. You published a book in December a little over a year ago, and it's called The Taste of Water. And in it, you're exploring the taste of tap water. And this is really interesting to me because I care a lot about tap water and how it tastes. My family used to look forward to going to our cabin north, and we'd always talk about it because the water tasted better there. The tap water tasted better than it did at home. Did you find that this was a common feeling as you were working on this book? Did you find multiple people who were also passionate about the taste of their tap water?
So There are kind of two camps of folks in the world. There are those who really pay attention to the taste of their water and those who say, you know, ideally my water tastes like nothing. And these two camps are often shaped, for example, by the experiences they've had. And across the board, people generally say that a water tastes good when it's of relatively low mineral content, doesn't have a lot of things like sulfur in it, it's cold, it's clear. Those are kind of standard definitions of good tasting water. But when you start talking with people and really spending time with them, you soon begin to realize that for some people, softened water is their ideal water. I find it absolutely disgusting, which is something I'm still surprised by. And as I've continued speaking with people and doing this research, I've really come to learn that we would do ourselves a favor if we pay more attention to the taste of our tap water and think about why did it come to taste that way and what does that tell me about the work that's being done upstream.
What you ultimately found was that consumer preferences on water taste were actually actively affecting what water treatment was being done, correct?
Yes and no. So the thing that has most shaped the taste of water over the 20th century has been this effort to make water safe. And so making water safe initially was something like, oh, we're going to filter it and then add chlorine to it. And the second you start adding chlorine to water, you shift the tastes and smells that people experience in their water. There's actually a lot of pushback in the early 1900s and still pushback in many places where people say the smell of chlorine is not the smell of safety. Many folks in the U.S. actually see it as the smell of safety. But you add chlorine to something, and if there's phenol, for example, present in it, it's going to make your water taste horrifying. And so for the early engineers and chemists who were tasked with trying to figure out how do we add enough chlorine to make the water safe, it also became this, wait, how do we not make the water smell or taste so bad that the folks receiving this water, like, we just don't want them to walk to City Hall and riot. So it was more, in a way, this kind of back and forth of just trying to figure out what's there and how do we deal with it? How do we minimize it so the outcry is as little as possible while also just making the water as safe as possible? Because we don't want our water to be killing people. But what's really interesting for me in the 20th and 21st century is the way that the taste of water that is largely anticipated by a consuming American public is what you could call the taste of bottled water. So somewhere in there, mid-1900s, pre-rise of bottled water, people would have just found their tap water, like, this is just the water you have. You accept it. Maybe you're going to refrigerate it because that's going to make it taste better. Throw some lemon in it. Definitely makes it taste better. But in general, you didn't have this massive bottled water industry inviting you to opt out of the water that was coming in to your municipal taps in the U.S. And yet by the end of the 20th century, you do. And many folks have come to say that for them, the ideal taste of water is, in essence, the taste of bottled water. How did that come to be? Why do we think that something that has this little plastic wrapping of various levels of quality is what water should taste like?
You've written that this turns water into a highly industrialized product as opposed to something based in the environment.
So I'm definitely thinking about municipal water production through that lens of the food chemist and through that lens of someone who has worked in the food industry. And this is where you think of a product that comes out of the food industry. Its main aim is to be consistent and safe overall. And then we're going to throw on, at least for corporations, the idea that it's going to make a lot of money. For municipal water providers who are publicly owned, it doesn't need to make a lot of money. It needs to ideally break even and leave a little bit of extra so they can continue to invest in the infrastructure. For private water companies, such as American Water, you could potentially argue that they also have a very strong profit motive that perhaps as inhabitants we should be paying closer attention to. But at the end of the day, if your municipal water quality varies quite a bit, what is coming out of the tap on Thursday is really different than what is coming out of the tap on Friday, those people who are receiving that water, there's an increased chance they're going to be calling the municipal water provider to say, hey, what's wrong? But also that they're going to stop trusting their water. And if we as a community really buy into the idea, and I do, that water is safe, water is a communal right that we really value everyone having access to, then we want the quality of our water coming out of the taps to be consistent day in and day out.
Let's shift from the taste of water to advanced water purification, or AWP. As I mentioned before, it's a potential solution to some of the challenges that drier areas like Arizona are facing due to drought conditions. Tell me a little bit about what the process of AWP looks like.
Sure. So as you pointed out in the introduction, Advanced water purification has many names. A previous iteration here in Arizona was advanced water treatment. So what they're doing with this is they're taking wastewaters. This could be gray water. It could be black water. Those are terms the industry uses to refer to different levels of wastewater. So gray water might be like the water coming out of your washing machine. Black water is the water coming out of your toilet. They're going to put it through the normal treatment processes that are currently mandated by the Environmental Protection Agency to clear out the solids and other things and then further treat it to remove dangerous bacteria and viruses. But rather than dumping it back into the environment or releasing it back into the environment, they're instead saying, okay, we're going to clean it up even more and dump it right back into the municipal water supply. And so this is where they might do some additional processes like running it through ultra filtration techniques like membrane filtration, reverse osmosis, and that's going to really remove all of those additional minerals that might be present. It's going to get rid of any potential like bacteria. It does a really good job of removing pharmaceuticals, things like that. And then they might further treat it with something like UV light, which will further break down anything that maybe made it through those super, 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 super tiny holes in those membranes. And then they test it a lot, and then they can dump it back in the municipal water supply. So you can imagine, for some folks, that's kind of scary, right? You're taking my wastewater and turning it back into drinking water.
Yeah, I imagine that it's hard to broach because people are put off by the sound, especially the word wastewater. The connotation of wastewater, no matter how cleaned, how processed, how recycled it is jarring.
I mean, we've been well trained to say, don't drink your wastewater, right?
Is that vernacular part of what makes it hard to broach this subject with different individuals, with different stakeholders?
I think there are a lot of reasons that folks find it difficult to talk about this, but at the most basic level, it really is that we have a 20th century view that says your wastewater and your drinking water should be distinctly separate streams, and that's codified in our regulatory processes. There's a lot of stuff in wastewater that we wouldn't want near our bodies. There's a reason we flush it away or wash it away. And it requires a lot of trust in two things to say this is a process I want to engage in. One is trust in the technology that it works, but the other is trust in your government, right? Trust that the government is looking out for your best interest, trust that your municipality and your state are functional, that they have enough money to replace the membranes appropriately, that they're willing to invest in the testing processes that they need to invest in to make certain it's safe. And for some folks, that's a really big ask.
You came up with this idea for this communication to become a two-way street, and it's a way for people to feel a little bit more heard. And it was in the form of these advanced water treatment pops. And these are popsicles. They're made with real fruit, and they're shaped by these community collaborative workshops. Tell me about these workshops.
One of the premises behind this is the idea that, you know, the people in charge of pushing forward advanced water purification, they're essentially saying to the rest of their constituents, the consumers in their watershed area, you're going to taste this and put this in your body and it's going to be okay. And what we're saying is, okay, this is a very visceral, personal, intimate thing the second you ask someone to open up their mouth and ingest something, right? So what if we invited the community members who have their own questions and concerns and curiosities to create something and turn around and ask the folks who've been saying, you will taste this, to say, well, why don't you taste my story too?
And what you did is you had different flavors represent different thoughts and you had them explain that. So for example, for one of the popsicles, watermelon represented the thought that it was good for hydration, but its juice wasn't transparent. Just like the water, you don't really know what you're getting into unless your leaders are transparent about all of the possibilities. And you had each different flavor represent a thought similar to this, right?
Correct. The biggest constraint we had actually was from our popsicle producers. So I'm not allowed to make these. I partner with someone who has the appropriate food handler's licenses and work in appropriate facilities. And I've had two amazing partners here in Arizona, Paletas Betty and AZ Pops. And they said, we essentially need you to offer ingredients that can be found in a grocery store. So those were my constraints, right? could be anything. And then we sat down with collaborators who had a year previous to this. Marisa had brought them together to really explore advanced water purification. So they had the chance to go up to Scottsdale and meet the folks working in the plant and learn about the water. And then we brought them back together a year later and said, hey, you've had a year to think about this. What do you think? And then worked through this process of helping them design the popsicles to say, okay, tell a story about what you think. What are your questions? What are your hopes? What are your concerns? And so each one of the design popsicles has that background of someone who's really been exposed through the process. They've had the education. They've tasted recycled water. And they've thought about it for a year. And by and large, they would say this is high quality water. This is water we're interested in. And as one person said, when can I get this water? But they also had, for most of them, some questions about what's the environmental impact? How much is this going to cost? Is everyone going to get this sort of quality water? And so they created edible stories that we turned into popsicles, and then we've shared them back with the folks who are making decisions around this process.
A common concern that I noticed was that the use of AWP was going to further the gap between more well-to-do areas and those that were less well-off. Tell me about that.
You know, I think this is a legitimate concern that folks all across the U.S. and frankly all across the world have, because it's pretty easy to look at things and see, wow, people who have a lot of money, also it's easier for them to access good health care, and there might be more trees in their neighborhoods, or maybe the streets are better paved. And so similarly, there's this concern of, hey, how do we make certain that the water coming to us, that our lives are as equally valued as the lives of the folks who, frankly, if they wanted to, can already afford to put in additional filtration systems into their homes to protect themselves, while maybe we can't. I think this is a legitimate concern that we should all share, because I at least think that one of our core values as a society should be, we want everyone to have access to safe water, but also, frankly, I think we should want everyone to have access to water that when they drink it, they feel safe drinking it because it tastes and smells good.
And a part of that, too, is wanting safe water for future generations. It's something that I noticed a couple of people spoke about, too. We depend on water more than we realize, and this is a potential solution to make water more accessible, which is really exciting and hopeful for future generations.
This is one of the things that I really appreciate about the folks who are working to come up with innovative solutions like advanced water purification, is they are thinking about future generations.
A common theme that seemed to be present in a lot of these popsicles was some fear or nervousness revolving around the whole process. But ultimately, I think for me, what I liked the most was that they generally ended with hope for the most part, it seemed. That those who participated in this workshop were hopeful for reclaiming water and were hopeful that it was a successful process despite some of their concerns and some of their fears.
This actually kind of surprised me. So when I have done a short version of this workshop, just with folks, we sit down and we bring in a bunch of Jelly Bellies, and sometimes I throw in the Bernie Bots Jelly Bellies and say, hey, you know, here we are, we're thinking about water recycling, tell me a story, give them the same prompts. If they haven't been through the process of meeting the people who are making their water and seeing where their water is made, they are often more hesitant. And so I think this raises for us a really interesting question about our responsibility or an opportunity for further engagement that we have as members of a community, which is to go actually meet the people who are producing your water and find out what it is that they're doing. A bunch of them are holding community meetings all the time. They love to have people show up.
Are you yourself hopeful that this is a realistic solution long term?
It is a very realistic solution, but it's also going to cost a lot of money. And I think that's really kind of the core question for us to think about is, do we want to have to pay that much money? And how are we just kicking the can down the road and doing it? So do I think we should move forward with this solution? If the community members have decided this is the best fit for now, yeah, let's move forward. But let's not stop talking about other solutions. Let's not stop thinking about ways in which we could further reduce our water needs. Maybe we don't need to wash our clothes as often. Maybe we don't need to buy so many new clothes. And in the process, how could we then, as we figure out new ways to preserve water, how might we also be thinking about new ways to preserve or protect the future of our water?
That's Christy Spackman. Christy is an associate professor of art and science with a joint appointment between the School for the Future Innovation in Society and the School of Arts, Media, and Engineering at Arizona State University. Christy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Reagan.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our executive producer is Matthew LaPlante. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot, and I'm Reagan Edelman. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.